This is the last day of this July 2011 seven-day session. And we'll take up another koan today. This is another one from the Mumon Khan. And it's number 32. It's yesterday we did 31. Today it just so happens that it's 32. And it's called A Non-Buddhist Questions the Buddha. This is how it goes. The case: a non-Buddhist once asked the world-honored one, "I do not ask for words. I do not ask for no words." The world-honored one just sat still. The non-Buddhist praised him, saying, "The world-honored one, with his great compassion, has dispelled the clouds of my delusion and has enabled me to enter the way." Making a deep bow of gratitude, he departed. Ananda then asked the Buddha, "What was it this non-Buddhist realized that he praised you so?" The world-honored one replied, "A first-class horse moves at even the shadow of the whip." So, I do have some material on Ananda. I'll be reading here from the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. He was the Let's start. He was one of the most important disciples of the Buddha. In fact, they called him one of the 10 great disciples of the Buddha. He happened to be a cousin of the Buddha, and he entered the order, the monastic order, 2 years after it was founded. In the 20th year of the Buddha's teaching, Ananda became the Buddha's personal attendant. He was famous for his extraordinary memory, in virtue of which he was able to retain the Buddha's discourses. Some of you may not know that that for the first 200 years after the Buddha's death, his words were transmitted orally. They weren't written down. And the collection of sutras, that is, teachings by the Buddha, is enormous. And Ananda is credited with having, as the Buddha's attendant, he just sucked up all these talks and was able to pass them on, and they were passed on, and they were passed on. It's a little hard to believe, but you know, there are people I've heard about who have, that are sort of idiot savants who have just impossibly good memories, retaining hundreds of digits, and they're able to recite pi up to hundreds of digits. Anyway, that's what the texts say, is that he passed all these on. Must have had some other people with good memories too, for if he went 200 years without writing them down. And his expounding, his transmitting the Buddha's words formed the basis of the first Sutra Pitaka, the codification of the Buddha's teachings. he was he became the Dharma heir, not of the Buddha. This is the really poignant thing about Ananda, is he didn't come to awakening under the Buddha. But he did come to awakening under the Buddha's Dharma heir, Mahakashapa. So Ananda is considered the second patriarch, and he's the name we recite in our, we chant in our ancestral line, the name after Mahakashapa. There's a little more here. Ananda is often extolled in the texts for his humility and his devotion toward the Buddha. When the Buddha asked him to become his personal attendant, he told the Buddha he would only do so if the Buddha could assure him that he would acquire no advantages as a result of his position as attendant. And when the Buddha did assure him of that, then he took the position. Ananda was credited with foiling this famous assassination plot against the Buddha. The evil Devadatta mounted this assassination attempt, and somehow Ananda broke it up. He was an advocate for the cause of women, more than anyone else at that time. At that time, Dharma discourses were not to be given in the presence of women, but he did so anyway. And it was under his pleading with the Buddha that the Buddha consented to the founding of an order of nuns. So that's all the material we have on Ananda. The key thing in terms of our today's koan is the fact that even though he was at the Buddha's side for years and years and years, hearing every word of the Buddha's teaching, he was not able to come to awakening until after the Buddha had passed. So back to the case. A non-Buddhist came to the world-honored one. I suppose one of the elements of this story that makes it a koan is that this non-Buddhist is a non-Buddhist. In ancient times, you hear read in the texts of this phrase heretic. It strikes us as awfully antiquated to talk about heretics. And I don't know that the Buddha himself ever used that word, but there was this, you know, insider-outsider thing. And would have been quite stunning to the Buddhists at the time that this man who had not taken refuge in the three treasures. We don't know what practice he had, what faith he had, if any. But I don't think it is so far-fetched to us today. There are enough cases of instances of people, non-Buddhists, coming to enlightenment. Not many, actually, but there are enough of them that it's not as shocking to us. I think of Eckhart Tolle, from what I can tell from reading his the material that I've read, sounds like he had a genuine awakening. I have some doubts about the effectiveness of his teaching, since he doesn't offer much of a practice. I guess more recently he's put together some kind of a practice. But anyway, you don't have to be a teacher to, or even become a teacher to come to awakening. There's the story of Flora Courtois. I read that story a couple times in Taisho, in Sesshin. I haven't in quite a while, but just a college student in the 1940s who found herself in deep, deep state of questioning reality, and who had a real, thorough enlightenment experience. And she had no idea what it was at the time. She, in her account, she writes that she didn't know anything about Buddhism or Zen, and so she just started feeling incredible one day. It wasn't until 25 years after the experience that her karma brought her to Yasutani Roshi out in the West Coast, and in questioning her, he told her he felt that it had been an enlightenment experience. And then she did get into Zen. There's some suggestion that certain great famous people may have had what we would call awakening. Rainer Maria Rilke's writing is just marvelous. Some of the things he says, some have suggested that Walt Whitman may have had an awakening experience. Abraham Lincoln, I've heard. And who knows how many others have had these spontaneous awakenings, didn't know what to do with them, didn't know what to call them, preserve them, could not preserve the insight because they had no practice to maintain the original insight. And then we can suppose that there have been, even among the ancestral line, that there are plenty of women, enlightened women, who never made it into the ancestral line. That's why I tacked on at the end of the ancestral line the enlightened women, centuries of them. Since all beings have this Buddha nature, this enlightened nature, why would people not be able to come to awakening under the right circumstances, the right conditions coming together? And we would say, Buddhists would say, that in the previous lifetimes they did a great deal of practice, and so their minds had already been prepared, had been readied to have such an experience. Harada Roshi mentions that in his introductory workshops, he used to he worked with a chalkboard, and he would sometimes draw an enso, one of these calligraphic circles, on the chalkboard. And he said that once, and upon drawing that circle, a woman in the introductory workshop had a kensho. So it doesn't seem so far-fetched that just because this guy was not a member of the Buddhist order that he would have this experience. But to Ananda, it may have been just too much. Here he was all these years, he'd become a monk, completely devoted to the Buddha, right at his side all the time, and here comes this guy waltzing along who doesn't know anything about the Dharma. And he opens with a question to the Buddha. I do not ask for words. I do not ask for no words. He's probably heard his share of words. Maybe he's been to other teachers. And somehow, the words never caught for him. They never had the power of opening his mind. And he may have, for all we know, he may have tried a practice of silence. This is as old as the hills in various mystical traditions, maintaining silence. And that hadn't worked for him. So, in effect, he's asking, what is beyond words and silence, both of them? Maybe been like a kind of a natural koan for him. Maybe he was someone himself who had a very verbal character, loved words, loved reading, loved speaking, loved studying. But they had never brought him the peace of mind that he was looking for. He could come to the end of the line with words. And yet, he may have known that just keeping your mouth shut doesn't work either. There was a guy who came to the center in the early days of the center, who had gotten in his head that he was just not going to talk, and Roshi thought he was mute. There's a kind of romantic quality to this, you know, going around. He would, of course, attract a lot of attention to himself by being, you know, what they say, the one who knows does not speak, the one who speaks does not know. So he played that out. Actually, if I may confide, to you, he's an antique dealer in Rochester, and there's a show on in the middle of the day, a local talk show, Bob Smith, and every week or two, Bob Smith has him on answering questions. People call in, ask questions about their objects they have, and Jack is one of the people who answers these questions. And he doesn't seem to be shy about using a lot of words. isn't it often the way it works, where he may have just been quite a chatterbox, and he was trying to work from the outside. Okay, all right, I know. I'm always talking. My whole life, everyone tells me how much I talk, and I gotta shut my mouth, so I'm just gonna do it. And Roshi said that then we had this thing in the early years of the center. We had a parents' weekend, and his parents came. And Roshi said to the parents in a very kind of quiet and accepting way, he said, I'm sorry to hear about Jack. And they said, what do you mean? He said, well, that he's mute. And they said, are you kidding? We can't shut him up. we can suppose that given what follows here, what happened with this non-Buddhist coming to awakening, that he was in a desperate state. It's almost necessary as the precondition for awakening. You have to be just in a cul-de-sac. You have to be at your wit's end. Maybe he had really been working specifically on this question: how do I not get caught in words, and then without also just taking refuge in silence? What is there beyond that? And the Buddha's response was that he just sat still. Did he meet this seeker's question? Some might look at it and say, "Well, wait, that's no words. How does he meet the challenge there? It's not the same. It's not the same. No words is one thing, but what the Buddha showed was something else." There's a famous story involving Bodhidharma, founder of Zen. When he was near death, he called his four chief disciples together and asked them to state their insights. The first one said, "According to my view, we should neither cling to words and letters nor dispense with them altogether, but only use them as an instrument of the Tao." It's not bad. In words, he's pointing to what the Buddha was showing in his silence. The master said, "You've got my skin." Then a nun came forward and said, "In the light of my view, it is like Ananda's viewing the Buddha land of Akshobhya, seeing it once and never again." I don't know what that means, but it must have been pretty famous. Bodhidharma said, "You've got my flesh." And then a Dao Yu said, "The four elements are all empty. The five skandhas are all unreal. Looking from where I stand, there is not a thing that can be grasped." Bodhidharma said, "You've got my bones." And then finally it was Wiko's turn. Wiko became his Dharma successor. And Wiko just sat still. And he bowed to the master. And the master said, Bodhidharma said, "You've got my marrow." And he named him as his successor. What was the Buddha teaching in that stillness? What was he not teaching? What could have been deficient about that response of silence? It's all inclusive, all-encompassing. This is not the silence that stands dualistically against sound. It is the sound of silence, the silence of sound. A Buddha on an altar, a Buddha figure on an altar, is doing wonderful teaching in his silence. Starting with his posture, it's all there, the tremendous repose, the settledness, the dignity of his original nature, our original nature, the nobility, the serenity in the face, the collectedness, the integration. It's all there. In our zazen, really, it's our silent zazen that is teaching everything to us. It's all there. It's the source. Nothing lacking, nothing in excess in this silence. Of course, the Buddha also filled volumes of teachings in his teachings. But in this occasion, he must have known intuitively that what this man needed was that response. It's a remarkable thing, this practice. It's all within us. What the teacher does is nothing compared to what is wide open and available to the student. Great, bottomless well of wisdom that just keeps giving and giving and giving. We keep drawing from this every time we sit. We don't need to be told anything, truly. We don't need to be taught. We know it all. In our true mind, everything is resolved. It's just a matter of mining this wisdom with which we are endowed. And to do that, it really helps to be silent, to have the mind settle, to clear, to have the mind clear and open so that this great treasure of our intrinsic wisdom can be understood. And the non-Buddhist then said, "The World Honored One, with his great compassion, has dispelled the clouds of my delusion and has enabled me to enter the way." And he made a deep bow of gratitude and he left. Well, Ananda, having been there to witness all this, turned to the Buddha. What was it? What was it this non-Buddhist realized that he said these things to you? Well, what did he realize? can suppose that the Ananda was just flabbergasted at this. After all the words he had memorized and the time he had spent with the Buddha, and to see this outsider, so-called, to see him come to awakening with no words, must have been just left him completely at a loss. Well, maybe not completely, otherwise he would have, same thing might have happened to him. It's the whole point, is to lose it all. But he couldn't restrain himself. He had to ask the Buddha, what is that? What happened there? What? Of course, behind it is, how do I get that to happen to me? Behind that is pain. The Buddha didn't answer his question directly. Well, you see that the guy must have had an empty mind, and so when I was silent, then he... No explanation there. He didn't respond to Ananda with this line from the Tao Te Ching: the truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. Would have been, actually, in words, it would have been a good response to Ananda. The truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. Instead, he just says, a first-class horse moves at even the shadow of the whip. This refers to a parable in one of the sutras, saying that some horses, a first-class, a horse that is really ready, all it takes is the shadow of the whip. For another horse, it takes lightly touching the flesh. Another one, it takes more than that. And then the other kind of student takes, they have to shake the bones of the horse to get it to move. Well, it's easy to, when hearing this, to start trying to figure out which kind of horse one is. Please don't do that. because inherently we are all this first class horse. We are all, there's nowhere to move, really. There's nowhere to get to. There's nothing to attain. And in any case, we never know. We are mutable. We change. In the beginning, I think most of us are the fourth-class horse. And I remain forever grateful to the heavy use of the stick that was meted out on me to get me to move. We can suppose that it was Ananda's very brilliance, his intellectual brilliance, and particularly his Velcro memory, that may have been his obstruction still at that time. Roshi Kapil used to quote Harada Roshi saying, it's people, the intellectual, the people with the keenest, most subtle intellect, who tended to have the hardest time breaking through their first koan, because they tend to like to play with ideas. Their world is largely a world of ideas, and they relish making connections among the different ideas and reading and learning and acquiring knowledge. And all of that is well enough, but when it comes to seeing beyond everything, then it can be an obstruction. There's a story I found by a Maurice Maeterlinck, who was born in the 19th century and died in the middle of the 20th century, who offered this analogy. He said, if you place in a bottle half a dozen bees and the same number of flies and lay the bottle down horizontally with its base to the window, you will find that the bees will persist till they die of exhaustion or hunger in their endeavor to discover a way out through the glass. Whereas the flies, in less than 2 minutes, will all have sallied forth through the neck on the opposite side. It is the bees' love of light, it is their very intelligence that is their undoing in this experiment. Whereas the feather-brained flies, yeah, don't you wish, the feather-brained flies, careless of logic, find salvation where the wiser will perish. And then Roshi Kaplow would further quote Harada Roshi, saying, is when that person with that keen, subtle intellect does come to awakening, then they have the gifts, they have the talent to be an especially good teacher. Harada Roshi himself had been a philosophy professor at a university before becoming the Zen master that he was, at least doing it full time. So he knew a bit of how we can weave ourselves into a web with our thoughts, our love of knowledge. This is very much in the Zen style, this response of the Buddha, first class horse moves it, even the shadow of the whip, rather than saying, well, Ananda, rather than being directly speaking to him and saying, yeah, your mind's still clogged with thoughts and you gotta spend more time in the Zendo and less time in your books. And, you know, does it indirectly. A first-class horse moves it even the shadow of the whip. Ananda would have been familiar with this analogy of the four kinds of horses. Let's also point out that you don't have to be an intellectual to be addicted to your thoughts. All right, just that. And then Mumon's commentary. Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding falls far short of the non-Buddhists. How different are they, the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Well, they have plenty of differences. Differences in appearance, differences in their backgrounds, their personalities had differences, their bodies were different, their temperaments were different. But all of that is just on the surface compared to the unfathomable magnitude of what they shared, this self-nature, this true mind, this original mind. and Mumon's verse, walking along the edge of a sword, running along the ridge of an ice floe. You need take no steps. Let go your hold on the cliff. Comes a time when we just get sick of holding on to our thoughts. We get sick of pursuing our thoughts and lingering in our thoughts. There's a writer, Anais Nin, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that, French woman, who used the phrase in one of her books, and then the time came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk to blossom. What risk is there in letting go of our thoughts, putting our mind 100% into the practice? Well, it's a perceived risk. The risk is, who would we be if we dropped our thoughts? What would that be? It's a very, very profound fear that many people have about an empty mind, about the silence of an empty mind. They don't even maybe think it through. It's this just there's an avoidance, a pattern of avoiding the silence, the inner silence, that builds up for years and decades, where it can somehow provoke a kind of a recoiling from the silence and clinging to thoughts as what they imagine to be a defense, a protection against this void that they completely misunderstand. In a way, we can say that just about everything we do when we're not absorbed in the practice, about everything we do is a kind of avoidance. It's a recoiling from the void, an avoidance. But eventually we're willing to take the risk. And what do we find? That it was all unfounded, our fear of plunging into this true mind that we all share. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.